Talk given Friday, 13th August 1976. You may recall that in some of our previous meetings during the last few years, it was suggested that one of the purposes of our existence is that each person shall so grow and come to fruition within himself that he becomes a focus point for the free inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. And by transcendent energies, I do mean energies of which we have no knowledge at all at our present stage of development, either as individuals or in terms of humanity as a whole. Nevertheless, although we don't know about it, it is a fact. And it is a fact which has been realized by the few throughout the millennia. When I say few, I don't mean in tens or twenties or even hundreds, but probably some thousands have realized this, realized in the sense that it had become reality in them and through them. We have to remember that man has been on the globe a few million years. And during that time, you can imagine how many thousands of millions of human beings have been born and lived and died. Of those thousands and thousands of millions, there have been perhaps some thousands who have really awakened within themselves, seen the vision and the factual truth of what it means to become a complete mature human being and have so lived that they did flower out into perfect human beings in the full sense of the word human. Since we have two or three new friends today, bear with me if I repeat the real meaning of the word human. It's derived from the Sanskrit root man, and the prefix is hu, H-U. The root man, if you look into a Sanskrit dictionary, will merely tell you that it means to think, to make, to do. Man, especially to think. The verb manyate is derived from man. Most of the world will agree you and I will be agreed that yes, man is a thinker, as we say. But here we are under a delusion that man is a thinker in the sense that you and I are thinkers. Consider so deeply that you become aware of the fact as a fact that what we call thinking is just inaudible chatter. It's a stream of words, and that stream of words makes sense insofar as the concepts which they represent are put together in a meaningful pattern. And you will notice that all this thinking, this inaudible talk that goes on in the brain, is concerned entirely with oneself, with the knowledge we have already gathered, with the known, with the past, and it is entirely dependent upon the way in which our senses function and upon the way in which the functioning of our senses is interpreted by our conditioned brains. Therefore, you will see that all our thinking, although we are so proud of it and esteem it, we talk of the great thinkers and so forth, is really not of very great or even ordinarily great significance. There is something more. More not in the sense of something which is added on to this, but more in the sense of functioning in terms of a new, truly creative dimension of being and consciousness. Just as you cannot pack a solid object into a surface, because a surface has only two dimensions, length and breadth. A solid object has three dimensions. It's totally impossible to pack a three-dimensional object into a two-dimensional surface. So too, this new dimension of being and consciousness, which touches, which in some mysterious way is in intimate contact, in certain cases, of course, is intimate contact with this extra-dimensional state, no thought, that extra-dimensional state cannot be compressed, expressed in terms of thought or feeling or symbols or any sort of representation, re-presentation that you or I are capable of making. Now you see the implication of this. Man, the root word from which our word mind is derived, you see, man really represents man, the creator, because this man is the energy, this transcendent energy, which is the truly creative energy. Man's inability to express it is clearly shown through all the scriptures of the world. When, take the example from Genesis, God said, "Let there be," so and so was. Supposing they had written, "And God minded, let there be so and so was," you'll come nearer to it. Take that other verse out of the first chapter of Genesis, and Elohim, which is one of the names of this creative energy, said, "Let us make man in our own living image." All right. If you and I are in that living image, that essence of creative power, which in Buddhistic terms is referred to as essence of mind, but the reference is in terms of words and thoughts, and this is where the difficulty comes in. This creative energy, this ultra-dimensional thing, which we don't know here, is us in innermost actuality. So we are the living images of that. The thousands of millions who have been born and lived and died have never been the living image of Elohim. They have reflected, they have distorted Elohim, God, transcendence, the infinite, the absolute, pure mind. Use any phrase you like, any word you like. So now, man means this, and the prefix hue, which is in Sanskrit also interchangeable often with su, su, you see, means that which has gone well, that which has come to fruition, that which is happy. It's a wonderful thing to begin to wake up to the true meaning of the word human. Now, this is the fundamental concern of religion, which all the ordinary theologies and the doctrines and the dogmas and all the tomes and so forth which have been produced don't deal with, for the very simple reason that they can't. What can you say about this thing? As I said, you can't pack a solid object into a surface. You can't pack God into man as he is, as you and I are. Get it? And yet, this is the marvel about man on the globe, which doesn't apply to the other kingdoms of nature on earth. That man has that in him which somehow can so flower out that that other thing will affect man and the world. That other thing will pack itself into us. This is at the root of religion. Its very heart and soul and power and marvel and mystery and wonder and absoluteness. It is a creative pulse which is continuous regeneration and reabsorption into itself, commonly called the life-death pulse. But I always call it the life, other life pulse. I never use the word death, because death in the minds of mankind is associated too much with the feeling of annihilation. So they invent all kinds of theories about continuity in heaven or hell or reincarnation and all the rest of the rubbish. Out of ignorance, all these things have been invented. They don't know. They haven't begun to know just precisely what happens and what is the significance and meaning of this creative pulse. Now, when the human, the person, you and I, so live that we really grow into our full maturity, this creative pulse touches us. I've sometimes, certainly in each of the books that I've produced, have used this phrase, the lightning of transcendence strikes you. And it doesn't strike you dead, as it would, as ordinary lightning, electrical energy lightning would strike us dead. It strikes you alive. It strikes you into your real livingness, into your eternal being, your mortal, temporal, finite, manifested existence as a psychophysical organism. This perishable thing is the very instrument through which that lightning of transcendence manifests itself in all the world. Now do understand this carefully. Because if you do understand it, you will cease to struggle to attain anything. You will cease to plan for your future, either in terms of a comfortable front row seat in heaven, or as a more developed, a more advanced stage, born again on the earth. When the existential manifestation dies, the organism dies, all the elements that have been brought into being by this mysterious energy, this power of life, all those elements completely go back to their primordial state and become utterly unidentifiable. This is the point. There is no entity. We have, in our modern science, also discovered this extraordinary thing, which is a faint analogy, and beware of analogies, they can be very misleading. It's a faint analogy. We know that the chemical atoms of sulfur or gold or iron or oxygen or helium or anything, they are all sort of fundamental atoms. An oxygen atom remains an oxygen atom. We know that it is made up of protons and neutrons and electrons. Now, we can identify an oxygen atom as compared with an atom of iron or silver or whatever it is. See, they display different properties. All oxygen atoms are alike. For general purposes, we'll say they are alike. There are very, very slight variations, but never mind that. You see? Well, once you get to the realm of electrons and protons and neutrons, they are utterly indistinguishable. Every proton throughout the universe is just a proton. You can't name it, oh, this is oxygen's proton, or it is platinum's proton. It's nobody's proton. The identifiability as separate entity has vanished. Now, this is what we find so difficult to understand in relation to ourselves. We want to continue this I consciousness, This is the root of separate selfness, the root which gives rise to greed and hate and delusion, fear and violence and so on, and downright stupidity. And look at the evil that man does in the world. Is there any other creation so wonderfully capable of evil as man is? And because we don't like the idea of facing the fact inside ourselves, we relegate that evil by anthropomorphizing it in Mr. Satan and all his diabolical crowd downstairs. You see how ridiculous we can be? Now, this separate self, if we really understood that there is no identifiability, once you really see that, then there is no struggle about being unselfish and all that nonsense. You just naturally are selfless. You can't avoid it. Goodness, beauty, truth, all the wonderful things have not to be striven for at all. They are constitutive of us. Only we have covered over our real constitution with a lot of dirt through our ignorance and our fear to let go and be at ease. This is one of the most powerful sources of all our sorrow in the world. In fact, probably the most powerful source. We have to understand this. And we have to understand it not merely intellectually, in terms of thought. You start that way, because thought is just a pattern of words. And concepts and thoughts are impotent in the grand sense. They are very potent in the superficial sense of the turmoil and the stirring up of things, the disturbing of the peace of God that passes understanding. Concepts and desires and our drives and our ambitions, they are all wonderfully potent that way. But they are utterly impotent to release this transcendent peace within, which is the actuality of the sublime, unoriginated, independent, non-dependent nirvana. Now, here is a way of approaching reality, ourselves, our own life and all our problems, in a way which can release us as psychophysical organism into that state of order and harmony and fruition which enables us to be representative humans, man in the living image of that creative energy with its perfection, its indescribable perfection. If and when that happens, then what's so many of the things that the great mystics of the world have written through the ages happen. They become realities. They have written of it, they have spoken of it. But in the very writing and the speaking, they have hidden the fact. That's inevitable. No one can ever write or think or speak of this. When it does happen, and speak the truth. But although he cannot speak the whole truth about it, because it's an unspeakable reality, it cannot be contained within words which deal only with the realm of the mortal, although he cannot do that, even these inadequate, sometimes almost misleading words, if they come from one who has realized, and if they are given utterly freely, with purity and with love and deep understanding, they can stimulate the listener who is ready to make the flight through the uncharted abyss into this wonderful, mysterious unknown. This is why we venture to talk about it. Otherwise, we wouldn't dare to talk about it. Now, do appreciate that since this belongs to a dimension of being and consciousness which utterly transcends our whole ordinary life, caught in the sphere of mortality, something which begins, proceeds, and dies. That's what I mean by the sphere of mortality. This other thing, if you are ready, if you have so grown, will suddenly be there. You don't know when it comes, and it will suddenly disappear. And it will suddenly come, and it will suddenly disappear. Now, this doesn't mean that it comes, it goes. If that were the case, that it would just be another entity. And any entity is a thing of mortality, a thing of death. That is why all the theologians who have presented God as an entity, another chap, another deliberately using a slightly not very respectful word, chap, another chap, are hopelessly false. They are just misleading everybody. They are only talking of themselves in apotheosis when they do that. So, when I say it comes, it goes, it means this. If you and I realize that state of fruition, that state of maturity, this state is not a fixed thing. Because you and I are living beings, so it is not a fixed thing. It varies in intensity. It varies in the intensity of its receptivity and its responsivity. But you can't command that to appear when you feel you would like it to appear. It will never do that. When your own receptivity, because of the life you've led, the religious life, because of your own purity, you have so released the dormant possibilities within your own being that that omnipresent, mysterious, ever-functioning, creative action in eternity suddenly is felt by you, the separate mortal person. And it's not an emotion. It is not a thought. It has no relationship to any of the senses that we possess. When people say, oh, I had a vision of God and the angels, or I saw with my own eyes, this is how they speak, if they are saying the truth. As, for example, in the case of the great founders of the religions, you do find them speaking in those terms. But a great many mystics have spoken of it as if these were objective experiences. They are not objective experiences. Because objective experiences belong to the mortal. This, which is the immortal, the absolute, the infinite, which cannot be characterized. You see? Cannot be compressed into our vision. We say that we heard the voice of God as clearly as when I hear you talking and so forth. That's all stuff and nonsense. That's merely a way of talking of the untalkable. So beware. Now, it deals unto you absolutely all the time. Be very careful again. I said, it deals unto you. It has no wish. It has no desire. It has no conceptions. It has no will in our sense of the term. It doesn't make shapes. It is formless. It has no life in our limited biological conception of life. It is transcendent. So, what can I do? No one in the world has produced a vocabulary which could possibly, and no one can produce a vocabulary which can express this peculiar activity of the absolute, of transcendence. And remember that the word absolute, for example, in Zen Buddhism is identified as the meaning of the word Buddha. Huang Po says Buddha is the absolute mind, pure mind, and all the rest of it. You see, it's not possible to talk about it, but it is perpetually active. That creative pulse is in action. So in that sense, it deals unto every one of us. Don't try to picture how it deals or what it deals. Perhaps the least misleading way of trying to understand it, when the brain is quiet, and the mind and the senses are pacified, the least misleading way, perhaps, is just to say that the presence is felt. Provided there is no shape or name or quality given to that presence. It has a transmuting influence upon you, the living person. To us as living persons, it happens in terms of the movement of time. It happened yesterday. It happened 10 years ago. And every time it happens, it's totally new. It's not recognizable. See what I mean? It's totally new. And what the result is, it's very difficult to see the result. We have our criteria, our evaluations, and our standards of judgment when we use the word result. But they are hopelessly inapplicable in connection with the result of how it affects the whole world when it happens to you, when it deals unto you. This, of course, is partly a matter of faith. And largely a matter of seeing totality. When you see totality, all judgments disappear. For or against, all our criteria and values just disappear. You know how often I have said, it is important for those who care for religion, the religious life, which means the flowering of you, the human being, the individual, fully into humanity, in the profound sense. For those of us who care for this, we must set our sights on transcendence. But you see, there are thousands and thousands of earnest-minded people, good-hearted people, but rather ignorant people, who interpret this phrase, set your sights upon transcendence, in terms of a picture which they raise in their minds. The picture is false every time. God is good, God is merciful, God is gracious. Has anybody said God is a devil? And why not? Because he is ignorant. The man who speaks is ignorant. If he wasn't so ignorant, he would be capable of seeing, yes, God is a devil. Why? We associate the devil with that which hurts, that which is evil, that which is sorrowful, that which brings destruction and turmoil and upheaval and upset and everything. Think of the story of the Garden of Eden. We associate the word devil with that. But consider this creative energy which throws out the universe of manifestation of identifiable entities as they appear to us as separate entities, throws out that which must of necessity be smashed up and broken up, destroyed, in order that the freshness and the beauty of new birth may take place. But we can't stand that. We don't like it. It hurts. It's unpleasant. And we have no insurance in connection with that. You see, we think we are religious. We imagine so. But we are only playing on the fringe. And most of us, the earnest people too, it's more religiosity than true religion. Religare, to relate back. To the fundamental source, which is itself the goal, which itself is the absolute all. Now these are the things. Oh, I'm sorry, it sounds conceited talking like that. But in some such way as this, some such way, we gradually free our eyes from at least one or two of the veils that hide the truth. So, set your sights on transcendence, of which you make no thought shape. Hear, O Sariputta, remember your Heart Sutra? free from thought coverings. Remember that phrase, free from thought coverings. And Avalokiteshvara is in that supreme state where the absolute, the lightning of transcendence has struck. And he sees the truth of this, sees it not as an object outside himself, but he sees it because he is it now. He has become the truth. That is why all the great teachers said, I am the way, the truth, the life, and so on. So set your sights upon transcendence in that way. Which means, if you like, be completely open-minded and give your whole heart and being to that transcendence, the void, the unknown, the mystery. Don't be afraid of that unknown. Now, in a few simple words, how does one release oneself from one's psychological prison house so that you can let this divine mystery to come to flower through you? It's very simple. Just purity. Very simple to talk of. Superhumanly difficult to realize. Not achieve, realize. Just purity of thought, feeling, word, action, relationship. That purity is essential as the fundamental basis, and purity here is associated with pure morality, therefore, first and foremost, because with that present, all the resistances that the self-oriented, self-centered, psychophysical organism offers are out. I am an opaque, solid, murky block. How can any light get through me? But if I am utterly pure and clean, I am transparent. And the light of transcendence goes through just like that. Now you see, this is one of the deep meanings of yoga and all the so-called techniques of yoga. But one of the great revelations that was given certainly in the old days by the full-fledged yogi to his disciples, after he had taken the disciple through the stages of purification, which tamed him, through the stage of the discipline of the body, which prepared the temple for the reception of the Supreme, the Absolute, and which trained him so that his mind was at peace, poised, clear-seeing, sensitive. The final stage was to tell him and to enable him to understand that it was necessary for him to be free of all possessions, of all grasping, including grasping at virtue. Now that marvelous little Christian mystical treatise also, The Mirror of Simple Souls, Le Miroir de Simple Âme, written by Marguerite Poretti in the early 14th century. She had the full vision, and the church burned her at the stake for the things she said. But she spoke truth. One of the sentences in that book, "Virtues, I take leave of you." The Buddha says precisely the same. I'll deal with this a little bit at the summer school. I'll show you chapter and verse for it all. His own words. And it's not likely that he was exaggerating or telling lies. You see? Be free of not only the virtues as such, but even the sublimest exalted states of deep jhana and samapatti, the deep states of consciousness. The Buddha was a supreme yogi, remember. And those old yogis did teach their disciples, you have to be utterly free of this, non-grasping. And the Buddha also adds, be free of this, and how much more so, therefore, of the evil things. Now, there are a good many not very wise people in the modern world who come across these teachings and say, oh, you can eat, drink, and be merry, and, wine, women, song, and anything else you like to add on, spices and cakes and so forth. And all you've got to do is to breathe like this and sit like that and go through these things and perform your mantra jantar, as we sarcastically say in India. We don't just say mantra, we say mantra jantar, magical rubbish, you see. And lo and behold, you will be a Buddha and you'll be in nirvana. Nothing of the sort. You will be a very foolish person and have the misfortune never to know it. Therefore, you will be a source of evil in the world. Be very careful about these things. The fundamental basis is the purity in thought, word, deed. The cleansing of the mind, the purifying of the heart, the feelings, the emotions, so forth, and the utter purity of action. And the purity of action includes what the world calls inaction. At least 99% of the activity of the world is misdirected, foolish, destructive, evil activity, making for the sorrow of the world. And we today particularly, and especially the last 8 or 10 years, have ample cause everywhere in the world to see the horrible things that are happening. Man in the living image of God. You see? So, there, if you like, is the way. Now, lastly, for today, don't think for a moment that you or I can buy nirvana with our virtue, our purity, our mental concentration, the development of our psychic abilities and all the rest of it. You can't buy transcendence. You can't buy and sell the spirit. Perhaps the most powerful expression of this, the most uncompromising expression of this truth, has been given out by Muhammad. Whosoever you are, saint, sinner, whatever you are, whatever you may be, if Allah wills that you shall be in hell, to hell you'll go. Now, as we say in slang English, put that in your pipe and smoke it. You see? You cannot barter with transcendence. You do it, you live the holy life, the pure life, the religious life, you come to the fruition that is possible for us here on this planet. We come to our full fruition as a sacrifice of self completely and totally to the purposes of this transcendent reality. Now, who wants to live the religious life after that? Do you still feel the urge? Or, perhaps, do you feel that, in fact, you have the power of 10,000 noble creatures inside you? There is another side. Whatsoever happens then, if your approach is the right approach, if your understanding truly flowers out, whatever happens, nothing can take away from you the marvel, the bliss of all those occasions when the lightning of transcendence strikes you into eternal life. But don't let that be the carrot that leads the donkey, because the lightning of transcendence in due time will strike the organism dead. Also, how do you and I die as an organism? Have you ever really meditated on it? Here we are breathing, and there comes the time when perhaps the breath rhythm becomes a little bit slower and slower. And there is an extraordinary relaxation of the entire organism. I first began to understand this mystery way back in the mid-1950s when I saw our cat dying. I saw the process of that death. The whole thing relaxes, and there is a state of extraordinary peace and beauty and bliss. And then suddenly, a last breath. Just like that. On this side of that was the living creature. Now, the creature's dead. This withdrawal of life transcendence does it. Whatsoever happens unto us, in a sense, is what transcendence does to us. Without doing anything in our meaning and conception of the word do. You see what a terrific purification of the mind is necessary to be able to begin to understand the height and the depth, the sublimity, the wholeness of things like this. But if you and I really care for religion, if we really care for our neighbor, if we really care for whatever the word God or essence of mind or Buddha or any word may typify, may mean for us, or to realize the state of the perfect yogi, then something like this is of the nature of that living. And if you do flower out spontaneously, naturally, like the bud spontaneously and naturally just becomes the flower without knowing it, without desiring it, without willing it, if it does happen to you, then you will realize the truth of the fact that through you transcendent energies flow freely in and out, affecting the life of the world, affecting the life of mankind. And that is an affecting which has no evil in it.